CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor. Voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, hunting down Israeli war criminals in the name of one of their youngest victims. And in the heart of Israeli apartheid darkness, an oasis of hope. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Clinging to the walls of a fertile valley beneath the city of Bethlehem, a half dozen kilometers south of Jerusalem, hemmed in by concrete walls, watchtowers, checkpoints, and a string of mega-colonial settlements, a biologist named Mazen Kumsier, his partner Jesse, and their friends are planting native Palestinian seeds, growing fruits and vegetables, raising chickens, rabbits, and fish, and offering up habitat for birds, insects, and other native Palestinian wildlife, rescuing their beloved landscape from the depredation and vandalism of Euro-North American settler colonialism. The Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability, their oasis is called. Occasionally, they venture out, traveling up, down, and across occupied Palestine, studying its flora and fauna. Since October 7th, 2023, these natural history forays have become increasingly difficult, if not impossible. More and more Israeli checkpoints block their way, and settler colonial violence makes the Institute's natural history work hazardous. The GPM spoke about native Palestinian biodiversity and the work of the Palestine Institute with Mazen Kumsier. Hello, Mazen.
Hello. Thank you for having me on your show.
Mazen, what's special about Palestinian flora and fauna, about the biodiversity of Palestine and the wider region? And one could go on, and I know you could go on about this for, you could give a whole hour-length lecture, but in a nutshell, tell me what makes Palestine so special biologically.
All right. Well, in two nutshells, really, two points that are worth making here. One is the geographic location, which is intersection of continents, Eurasia and Africa. This is the land bridge out of Africa. This is where humans migrated out of Africa to the rest of the world. And this land bridge, this bottleneck, has very rich biodiversity because of that. The second point is that Palestine is part of the Fertile Crescent, where our ancestors went from hunter-gatherers to agricultural communities. This is where it first happened, is in our region. And so the earliest human settlements happened here. And hence, that's also the earliest human civilizations, if you want. That's why it's called the cradle of civilizations. And so we have those two points, just to make two out of many. Of course, as you've said, I could mention many other things. For example, that this is an area of importance to many monotheistic religions and others. And of course, the geopolitical importance of the area.
Is Palestine a biodiversity hotspot? I know that the International Biological Institute, of whatever that convention is, they identify biological hotspots. Is Palestine one of them?
Yes. We are in what's called the Mediterranean hotspot for biodiversity. These are areas that must be protected as critical for the ecosystems of our planet to survive, is to protect these ecosystems.
So when you go venturing out, Mazen, you know, with your spade and your shovel, and we've been out on an expedition looking for orchids. But when you go out, where do you go? Where do you go looking for biological diversity? And I'm interested in focusing in on the Jordan Valley. The Jordan Valley is sort of like, it's one of those spots. But tell me about the Jordan Valley and other spots where you guys go to.
We could add as another significance to this area, Palestine, that we have the lowest point on earth, which is in the Jordan Valley at the Dead Sea, the lowest land area on earth. So the Dead Sea is, you know, hundreds of meters below sea level. And this diversity of habitats that occur here, the Dead Sea is actually a mere 25 kilometers away from me, or about less than 20 miles. And yet, within this very short distance, you find several habitats. We are in the Mediterranean zone, for example. And then you go to Iranian-Turanian habitats with different fauna and flora, and then some arid regions, and then the Dead Sea, Jordan Valley itself are subtropical climate because they are low and they get really different species. So within a very short period of distance, you get a lot of habitats, a lot of species of different kinds in those different habitats. So when I travel, you ask where I travel, I can travel short distances, if I'm allowed to, of course, if there's no checkpoints and walls and an apartheid system. I could travel within very short distances to the north. If I was allowed to travel to the north, I could get to the Galilee Mountains. If I was allowed to travel to the west, I could get to the Mediterranean Sea and coastal habitats even. And that's also not very far away from where we are, you know, about 60, 70 kilometers. So within short distances, you can have different habitats, you can get different species that are worth studying and worth protecting and conserving.
Let's talk about the Jordan, get back to the Jordan Valley. There's a lot of water in the Jordan Valley. It's kind of semi-desertified, but there's a lot of water under the ground there, and there are wetlands. What kinds of things do you see, animals and plants, do you find that are of interest? And tell me about the bats, right? Full disclosure, I brought down a bat detector last April to Mazin and Jesse and the Institute so that they could, you know, risking life and limb, I brought down this bat detector, and you were going to take it out there to look for bats.
Yeah, the Jordan Valley was rich in water before. It is no longer rich in water. A lot of the wetlands have dried up in the Jordan Valley, or I should say intentionally forced to dry up by the Zionist occupiers, starting from the north, from Lake Hula and the wetlands around it. That's gone pretty much. Lake Tiberias, Tabaria, as we say in Arabic, that's semi-disappeared now. Half of what it used to be 100 years ago. And the diversion of the water from Lake Tiberias from up River Jordan to the west by the State of Israel has caused drying up of the Jordan River, which used to flow at something like 1,350 million cubic meters per year, now flows at 20 million cubic meters per year. It's barely a stream. The wetlands around the Dead Sea and around the areas of the Jordan River are no longer big wetlands, very, very tiny wetlands, marshes. They dry up in the summer and so on. So there's devastation of the Jordan River basin and the wetlands around it on both sides of the Jordan River, the Palestinian side and the Jordanian side. And this has been studied well, and we know many species disappeared, many habitats were ruined, you know, that livelihood of people, for example, the Palestinians who used to live around the Lake Hula and wetlands of Hula, all these Palestinians were removed and they don't have a livelihood anymore. They live in refugee camps in Syria and Lebanon and Jordan. I could go on and on, of course, about this devastation of the Jordan River Basin, but you asked also about bats, so I want to get to that. Bats, of course, eat insects. At least most of our bats are. There's one species of fruit-eating bat here, but 22 other species are insect-eating bats. And these bats are devastated environmentally also because of this. When you don't have wetlands, when you don't have areas that they could drink from, even because Israel plugged the springs from flowing as they used to, and they did that because they don't want the Palestinians to have access to open flowing spring water, so they plug those and they take the water directly into pipes. But what that does, of course, is when you don't have open water, you devastate the habitats. There's no more living things around that water, frogs and toads and fish and so on, but also animals that need the water to drink. Like semi-arid regions, of course, when they have a spring, that's what's called an oasis. When you don't have an oasis anymore, because the oasis is gone, because the water is gone, sucked to go somewhere else, then you have a problem for the wildlife and also for the Bedouins, the goats and sheep of the Bedouins and the people that live around those springs, around those oases. But also things like bats and gazelles and ibex and foxes and so on are all devastated environmentally.
Are they? Are they? Have the ibexes and the Palestinian gazelles been devastated? Because in my time in driving through the Jordan Valley with various folks, and occasionally you see a gazelle or an ibex, I'm not sure I'd be able to tell the difference. And I think, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, they're still present, but their numbers are very small and very threatened.
How many of them are there?
Well, there's not been enough studies to tell the numbers. My own estimate for gazelles in the West Bank, for example, a whole West Bank, is between 2,000 to 5,000 gazelles total in the West Bank. In the Jordan Valley, no more than a few hundreds at best. It could be as low as 200, but there has not been many studies. This estimate I'm giving from my own, just observing the range of the gazelle and how many I see in a particular area and then extrapolating to the other areas.
And these are, I guess you could call an ibex and a gazelle a charismatic species. They're pretty exciting to see. They're gorgeous creatures, but then you've got the amphibians and the reptiles and of course, the bats, which are mammals. Tell me about the specific interesting species of amphibians and reptiles and small mammals that you see in the Jordan Valley and elsewhere around Palestine, that you get all excited when you spot one.
If we talk about mammals, and then we'll talk briefly about birds, but with mammals, most species of mammals are in two groups, the rodents and the bats. The rodents include things like gerbils and mice and rats and things like that. And the bats, of course, you know what they are. And there's, as I said, insect-eating bats and fruit-eating bats. In terms of rodents, we have some rodents that are endemic to the Jordan Valley. There are some bats that are found in semi-arid regions around the oases and are found in the Jordan Valley, but not found in most of the rest of Palestine and or Jordan. In terms of birds, of course, birds are richer in diversity than mammals in Palestine. And mammals, we have about 124 or so species. In terms of birds, we have over 540 species of birds. But that's because also we have migratory birds that pass through here. And the Jordan Valley, by the way, including the Wadi Araba area down to the Red Sea, are primary migration routes for the birds flying from Eurasia to Africa through this land bottleneck of Palestine. There's estimates of as many as 700 million birds that used to migrate through here. Some people say 500 million, but whatever, hundreds of millions of birds used to migrate through here. My own number would be much less than that, simply because of the drainage of places like the wetlands of the Hula area, which used to be stopover for migratory birds, a resting spot where they drink and eat a little and then continue down to Africa, or the other way around, from Africa to Europe and Asia. So we have a problem. Some species, of course, of birds are endemic also, like the Dead Sea Sparrow, that's found only around the Dead Sea. And these are threatened, of course, species, or some cases endangered, because of human activities around those areas. Israel is expanding settlements in the whole of the Jordan River basin. Also, Israeli industrial agricultural settlements, large-scale agriculture, where they use a lot of insecticides and pesticides. Those, of course, kill the insects that the birds and mammals like bats rely on. So this results in damage to our environment.
And yet the Israelis, the Zionists, they set up, they're famous for their so-called nature reserves. They seize land from the Palestinians and they build natural reserves, what they call them, which are planted with pine, European pine trees, and comment on this.
Yeah, this is not unusual in colonial history. I mean, if you look at the United States, the first national park, Yellowstone, when it was declared submission for Congress to recognize and establish the first national park, the justification given was to exclude the Indians, you know. So the only difference, of course, in our case is that the so-called nature reserves are not natural areas that are worth saving, so to speak. It's areas that Israel wants to exclude the Palestinians, and then they develop them as they wish. And the three areas they develop them in is either as residential Israeli settlements, or as industrial settlements, or industrial regions, areas, or the third is as military training zones. This is what they use most natural so-called nature parks or nature reserves in Israel for. And it's not based on any scientific studies of the nature or the biodiversity of the area. And we can see this actually from the looking at the agency, what is the group that is in Israel that designates nature reserves? Well, it turns out to be the Jewish National Fund, or Keren Kayemet Le'Israel, as they call it in Hebrew. And this Jewish National Fund is an entity that set up in 1905 to colonize Palestine. And it's still about colonizing Palestine. And how many staff, when they set nature reserves, how many of their staff are actually biologists or environmentalists or know anything about nature? The answer is zero. You know, they have no nature people involved in designating nature reserves. So the designation is literally about politics and Zionism, and not about nature or protecting nature.
Raja Shahadeh, the academic and writer who wrote a bunch of wonderful books, including one called Palestine Walks, which folks who've not read it should read it, by Raja Shahadeh. I'll link to it at the Green Planet Monitor. And he talks about how he and his family used to go on long walks through the West Bank, picking wild flowers and things you could eat. And this was a beloved Palestinian pastime, but I guess you can do that in some places, but it's really difficult and dangerous, isn't it?
Yes, it's becoming more and more difficult. I mean, even I, before, a couple of decades ago or so. I used to walk long, long distances, certainly from Bethlehem to Jericho or the Dead Sea is walkable and easy walk if you went down the hill, for about 30 kilometers or so. But nowadays it's virtually impossible to do this because of the settlers, presence of settlers and Israeli soldiers and checkpoints and walls and so on. As I said, even Jerusalem is here right next to Bethlehem. It's only 5 kilometers away. So I could theoretically walk through Jerusalem, but I'm not allowed to. There's a wall, there's checkpoints, and I'm not allowed into Jerusalem, even though I used to be a high school teacher in Jerusalem. I'm not allowed to walk to visit, let's say, the holy sites like Church of the Holy Sepulchre or Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
The area between Bethlehem and west of Bethlehem towards Al-Walajah and north towards Jerusalem are crisscrossed by these valleys of enormous biological significance. And we visited one of these last April. And but these days it's really difficult because it's all crisscrossed by barriers, the apartheid wall, and its various associated fortifications and roads and watchtowers, and it's terrible. Talk about all these valleys that crisscross the area between Bethlehem and Al-Walajah and Battir and north to Jerusalem.
Yeah, I mean, Bethlehem, let's talk about Bethlehem in general. Bethlehem district actually stretches from Jerusalem all the way to the Dead Sea. And it has a population of 270,000 Palestinians. About 35% refugees or displaced people from the 1948 ethnic cleansing that we call the Nakba. Catastrophe of ethnic cleansing. And we have three major towns, which are Bethlehem, Beit Jarrah, and Beit Sahur. And we have several nearby villages around Bethlehem, within the Bethlehem district. That includes the village like Al-Walajah that you mentioned. Let's mention Al-Walajah just to show you. Al-Walajah is from where I am now in Bethlehem to Al-Walajah. Is about 12, 15 kilometers. Well, there's two settlements along the way. There's roads, Zionist roads for settlers, apartheid system, there's walls, there's checkpoints, there's even a gate that they can close whenever they feel like it to separate Bethlehem, where I am, from the village of Al-Walajah. And what is the village of Al-Walajah? It's actually the new village of Al-Walajah, because the old village of Al-Walajah was destroyed and people were made refugees. And the new village of Al-Walajah were the refugees from Al-Walajah who had access to this land that belonged to Al-Walajah, but on the other side of the valley, other side of the Green Line. And they built a new village. Some of them, only 10% of them, live in the new Al-Walajah.
This was in 1948.
Yeah, most of the people of Al-Walajah were made refugees in 1948, all of them actually. And 10% were able to rebuild this new village of Al-Walajah, which is now surrounded on all sides by a wall and a gate that can be closed, of course, whenever at the whim of the Israeli soldiers. And they lost most of their land. They lost most of their springs, 26 water springs are now, of course, controlled by the Zionist colonialists. So Al-Walajah and its livelihood in that village, they just simply don't want them there at all. So they are pushing them out of Al-Walajah, as much out of the new Al-Walajah as much as they can to become refugees a second time. So it's very tough. And this is just one village. Of course, there are many others like Battir and Hussein and Nahalin. and they cannot even harvest their olives because Israel artificially set up these walls to capture maximum land, as they call it in Zionist ideology, maximum geography with minimum demography, meaning maximum land for the Zionist state with the minimum number of Palestinians, indigenous people who come with that land.
And Palestinians have traditionally grown just an incredible variety of vegetables and fruit-bearing trees all throughout this area. I mean, Battir is famous for it. It's like a cornucopia, but all this is being replaced by Israeli monoculture. Is that an exaggeration to say that?
No, I mean, as we said in the beginning of this conversation, Palestine is part of the Fertile Crescent, where humans first developed agriculture, first domesticated plants and animals, of course, like goats and donkeys and camels and so forth. That's a Fertile Crescent. That's where it happened. Now, why did humans, who were present throughout most of the areas of Asia, Europe, and Africa, why did this particular area be the first place to domesticate and the first place to have agriculture? It's because we had a rich land and rich soil and very, very healthy environment, not too cold in the winter, not too hot in the summer. So it was ideal for domestication of things like wheat and barley and lentil and chickpeas and olives. Olive trees were first domesticated here in the Eastern Mediterranean region in Palestine and Lebanon. So yes, we had diversity of agricultural crops. The Zionist movement decided that they don't want these rain-fed agriculture and other kinds of things that were domesticated here first, like chickpeas, hummus, lentils, wheat and barley. And they wanted to cultivate things that are Europeanized kind of versions of diets. That includes things like tomatoes and avocados and things like that. Not that these are European, but that these are Europeanized, if you want, diet of what they do. And that's what happened in the past 76 years. A transition in the agricultural production of Palestine. Not that Israel made the desert bloom, the reverse, actually. They made many areas desert, as I mentioned, the Jordan Valley, by diverting its water and so on, but also by changing the nature of the agriculture, the types of crops that are grown. And instead of, for trees, for example, instead of having olives, figs, and almonds and other trees here, many of them, millions of them, were uprooted, and Israel planted pine trees to give a European look to the countryside. So that's a monoculture of pine trees, and that's what they do. But that's what all colonialists do. I mean, look at Australia, look at the United States. What happened to the virgin forests? What happened to the native fauna and flora? How many invasive species did the Europeans bring to North America or Australia, and that devastated the local species? The same thing here. I mean, Israel brought a lot of European species that became invasive here and that are devastating the wildlife here. Sometimes not even European species, like the Indian minor bird that they brought for decorative, because it has a nice sound. But this is not a native species, and it's spread now here, and it's destroying the other native birds. So its original home is in India, actually. But Israel brought it to the area of Jaffa, Tel Aviv, and released it. So colonialists release invasive species that destroy local habitats, destroy the local fauna and flora. The reason for that, of course, is that the balanced ecosystem evolved over thousands of years here. And when you bring a species that's not local, doesn't have local enemies, it is not